I had not realized that until we started the conversation, and I realized that there's something more to this. But it also then became rather apparent to me that even if it's perhaps not so cool to like Eurovision in the UK, it is enormously cool to actually love Eurovision in Sweden. And we were hoping that somehow, by sharing some of the enthusiasm that we feel for Eurovision, that we might see a change here in this country. And there is so much more to it than just the show, as I think we will hear from the panel today. And I will say it's not only about the music, but we've also discovered the points at the end, which our foreign minister, Carl Bildt, takes a specific interest in. So he even travelled to the Eurovision final in Belgrade. He has a retro velvet jacket that he always wears for these Eurovision song contests. And he's definitely going to be in Malmö on Saturday. He was at the Swedish final in Stockholm. So there we have a clear supporter. Even our prime minister is very into Eurovision. There's so much to say about this contest, but I will not prolong this because I know we have such an exciting panel. But I think seriously that if this country decides to win Eurovision, you will win it. So that's what we're hoping for. And we have with us directly from Malmö, Christoffer Johansson, who is just going to say, well, I think we have Christoffer. There we have you. So just to present Christoffer, who, if you have any questions about Eurovision on Saturday, he will be around. But just to, for you to.
Now in Malmö, we really love the Eurovision, of course. And we're the host nation, or the host city this year. So if you guys have any questions at all, of course, I will be here moving around. I just thank you.
So, and I am now going to hand over to Fraser, who will present the panel, and he will then guide us to how we will see a future British win in Eurovision. Sorry, Fraser, I know
no
you might not know. Exactly. So, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Will I stand up or sit down? Or... Stand up? Right. Well, thank you, Nicole. Well, it's a great privilege to be here. I can argue with room-emptying conviction about my love of Eurovision. And I'll restrain myself a bit tonight, except to say it's an honour to be in such a panel of Eurovision stars. And today's my 40th birthday as well, so I can think of no better way, really. And neither can my wife, Linda, who's here as well. Now, us British are sticklers for tradition. And this Saturday, we're going to follow one of the newer traditions that we've acquired, which is to go in front of 64 million people and produce a song that will suck, unfortunately. Now, actually, it's not entirely fair on Bonnie Tyler. It's a good song. She's gone. It's actually, I was pleasantly surprised when I heard it. But not when you compare to Sweden, Iceland, Italy, Estonia. All of these countries have got a Eurovision entry, which is already at number one in their domestic countries. Bonnie Tyler hasn't even charted in Britain yet, despite the BBC giving her quite a lot of airplay. So it doesn't. I hope to be pleasantly surprised. But the one thing she can know is that she will not be the worst ever Eurovision entry, because you can't get lower than zero, which is what we acquired in 2003, when we were the first country ever, I think, to get nil point from tout le monde. And ever since then, we've been in a national huff, really. Britain has taken the view that we don't want to compete in your little contest anyway, or so it just seemed from the calibre of our entrance. We finished last three times in the last 10 years. So we're going into a sort of Finland-style state of depression that the Finns only got liberated with Lordi, sensationally. Now, all of this would make sense if it were somehow the Eurovision winemaking competition. Britain should come last at that. Or the Eurovision competition for good weather, we'd come last at that too. But Britain is actually rather good at pop music. I mean, every country in Europe has got something which is very good at. The French are great at wine, the Italians are good at leather goods, Swiss at clocks, the Greek at fiddling their accounts. But when you think about what Britain does better than anybody else, you've got to say popular music. Now, you just need to go to America, switch on the radio. You can hear our music there. Last year, we've got Adele, Mumford's, One Direction. These three artists produced four of the top five best-selling albums in America last year. That is incredible. British artists have produced the world's best-selling albums for five of the last 6 years. We sell 14% of global music popular hits come from Britain. And last year, we sold 16% of the pop music consumed by Germany and 17% of France. So we can come up with songs that Europe loves. We just choose not to do it on Eurovision night. And it's not even as if we can organise contests. We are the country of X Factor. We're the country of Simon Cowell. We're the country of Simon Fuller, who produced a Eurovision for the Arab world. He's got the formula. We can do it. But for some strange law of gravity, we just don't seem to. We can produce artists like Susan Boyle, who, for all the internal tittering you may be going through thinking of her, was the world's best-selling artist in 2009. That is what we can do. Now, what is the problem here? Now, I'm very glad that we've got Kevin Bishop here, who was the BBC's head of this for many years, because he can rebut the charge I'm about to make, but the blame can be laid at the door of the BBC. Now, the BBC, I love very much. I'm an avid consumer. It's brilliant news, brilliant documentaries, but it doesn't have the popular touch, I don't think. If you look at the way it campaigns for Eurovision at the moment, it's as if the whole thing is one big sort of Eurotrash the musical, some kind of camp festival that we're there to laugh at rather than be entertained by. The BBC has given up on providing competitions at all, completely, and in the last 2 years, the winner has been picked by an anonymous BBC guy, Emma Boot Humperdinck last year and Bonnie Tyler this year, picked. Now, there was a music contest where the contestants were picked by an anonymous bureaucrat. That was called the Intervision Song Contest, the Soviets' equivalent of Eurovision, when they were trying to compete against the West. And it didn't succeed then, and this approach isn't succeeding now. So I think that... Now, we've been here before. We have had a period where we had 16 years of hurt for Eurovision. And it was in 1994, a guy called Jonathan King took back it over, and he managed to get there a bit. He came up with Gina G, which was a brilliant hit here, didn't do very well in Eurovision, but he worked out. He almost quit when Gina G did so badly in Eurovision because he thought, well, perfect song, what could do it? But he worked out that Gina G's stage performance wasn't that good. So he came up with somebody who would have the proper stage performance. And that year, Britain did better than any other country in Eurovision history, collected 80% of the votes cast and won by a 40-point margin, the biggest ever. And the artist, the winner, sitting to my right tonight. So, if anybody knows how to pick Britain out of its Eurovision morass, actually, it's the three people here. Katrina has done it before. And Svente, on the left, took Sweden out of exactly the same morass in 2002, where it had been coming out of lackluster entries for a long time. The whole of Eurovision had lost its panache. And he invented a formula, Melody Festival, which is now, I think, Europe's leading way of providing the great hit factory, which gave us Loreen, and gave us even overseas panels voting, which overturned the victor for last week's Melody Fest. It came up with this guy, Robin, who is, an underdog, but still likely to do quite well. And, of course, to me, it's a mystery as to why the BBC does get this wrong. I'm sure there are very good people probably working with no resources. I also suspect the BBC has got a bit of a blind spot for popular culture. I mean, stuff like the Queen's Jubilee, the BBC couldn't work out what these strange people were doing celebrating, and they're actually having fun. And the BBC isn't very good at working at people having fun. So I'm sure Kevin will tell us if there is a way of saving Eurovision from the BBC. So I will just ask him questions and try to tease out tonight a subject very much close to my heart, which is why a country which makes the... We could win, I think, every single year if we only chose to compete. And the question is, how do we compete? So, I don't know, Kevin, since I've been so crude about the BBC, why don't you defend it and tell me a bit about why it is so difficult to get? Because we did actually, the year 2003 when we came last, that was after a regional panel had chosen this Liverpudlian act. So yeah. We did ask the people spoke, but the singers didn't sing in key. But it was, so it's not the fact that we didn't really try good act. We did consult the people. It just doesn't seem to work. So what's going wrong?
Well, it's very difficult. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. Because we did the same thing in the year that Katrina won. And I think it was very obvious to all of us that year that the song was really good. And, you know, in those days we had a music corporation who gathered all the songs together. And we did have some really good writers. And they sort of whittled it down to the final sort of 12 songs, which the public voted for. So, you know, we can do it, but you need the right songs in the competition. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously years when that doesn't happen.
Right. So, Svante, can you tell us a bit about how the Swedes do it right now? You were telling me earlier that there are 3,500 songs submitted each year of people competing to write the song for Sweden. Now, that's pretty incredible. How did you get to that stage?
Well, first of all, you must take this competition seriously. You must think that this is entertainment, for sure, but it's also a very serious contest. And I think the problem with this country might be that you're not really taking this seriously. You kind of joke at it. You say it's Eurotrash, and you get fired by Graham Norton and Terry Wogan and saying that this is just to laugh at. Let me tell you, Sunday I went to see a football game in Premier League. I saw, don't ask me why, but I did. I did see Queen's Park Rangers play. They were really bad, a bad team, bad players. And I'm sure I could make a lot of jokes about Queen's Park Rangers, but I wouldn't say that the Premier League is totally crap. They have their Van Persies and all the good players as well. Same thing with Eurovision. We have some really bad singers, some bad acts, but there's also big and good quality in there. And I think the day when a country takes this contest for serious and start to treat it seriously, that's also when you become successful. And if the BBC doesn't do it seriously, well, maybe you should ask ITV to do it. They're also a member of the EBU.
Well, it's now, Katrina, how serious were you in 1997?
I think that it really helps to have someone who's gathering and cultivating good songs, who really, really cares about the competition and has connections with songwriters. We were approached by Jonathan King in 1996, and he said, "Hey, you guys are known for a few good pop songs. Have you got anything?" And we just happened to have recorded a song called Love Shine a Light, which we stuck in the bottom drawer, because for the band, for Katrina and the Waves, it was 2 Eurovision. So we said, yeah, we've got the perfect song. It's called Love Shine a Light. It's got a really good chorus, and it could do really well. We think it could win. So we thought we handed over the song. We thought that probably a 17-year-old size zero blonde would be nominated to sing the song, and lo and behold, they came back to us and said, no, we want you to do it. And this is all Jonathan King thinking, no, we don't want a green bean. We want somebody. I mean, at the time, we'd had a career 2,000 gigs. So everybody thought, well, we need somebody who's going to get up there and not be put off by the you know, the mm-hmm. massive responsibility of representing the United Kingdom in the Eurovision Song Contest. I'd never seen the show before, so I didn't give a hang. I said, well, yeah, I can probably do that. The song only lasts 2 minutes and 58 seconds anyway, so let me at it. Well, of course, you've never experienced anything like the nerve-wracking trouser cacking experience it is to stand up there right before you're going to go on and sing this song, and you've got all that massive pressure. What I wasn't aware of was that there was this stigma against people doing Eurovision, that it was really cheesy or a last-ditch attempt. Well, again, I mean, we kind of looked at the figures, the amount of people who watched the mm-hmm. show, and we were trying desperately to have another hit. We were getting loads of support from the BBC. Loads. You know, we had the song went It was number two in the charts. We were on Top of the Pops for four consecutive weeks. We had so much support. I was really shocked when you said that Bonnie Tyler hasn't even charted, because it's a perfectly good song. And one of the writers is like one of America's greatest songwriters. His name escapes me. But, I mean, it's not like we're not trying.
Yeah.
I beg your pardon? Is it Desmond?
Desmond Child.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
this
he's
is
just
from her Nashville phase, is it?
Bonnie Tyler's Nashville phase? Mm. Well, you know, she's got a new album, and it's going to be released soon. And I think she's thinking, well, this is a wonderful opportunity to showcase one of the singles from it.
Yeah. But you said your song was, originally you thought it was too Eurovision. Can you expand on that a bit? What makes a song Eurovision?
Well, it was cheesy. It had no kind of, it had no real sort of grit to it. And as much as we liked the song, and I kept saying, God, that damn Love Shine a Light song, I can't get it out of my head. But we had to bottom drawer it because we just thought we were trying to be cool, you know, and we already had to live down Walking on Sunshine, eclipsing anything else we ever tried to do. So
worse things to live down.
Yes, well, yes. I mean, at least it was a positive song and not a dreary ballad. But, you know, there was just something about Love Shine a Light that kind of gave it that little bit of a cheesy mark of, I mean, when we recorded the song, we kept listening to all these ABBA records because we wanted it to sound exactly like ABBA because we love their production team so much. But then, you know, we had to wake up and smell the roses and think, this song doesn't fit on any album. It's going in the bottom drawer.
Now, Svante, in 2002, this Eurovision had a similar reputation in Sweden. And, I mean, you know, I guess Jonathan King was lucky to find in Katrina perhaps the only person in Britain who didn't know that Eurovision was cheesy and trashy and not to be done. But how do you actually go around turning around the reputation, not of something you produce, but of something which the Eurovision produces? I mean, you don't have much control over the image of a contest. So how do you go around changing that image?
Well, 2001, we had big problems with the Eurovision or the Melody Festival in Sweden. We didn't seem to attract the good singers. We didn't seem to attract the good songwriters. And that year, the final actually was in Malmö, by the way. It was probably the worst Melody Festival and final ever. We had, of ten acts, I think we had six dance bands, you know what I mean, the traditional Swedish simple tra-la-la songs. Then we had two or three totally unknown amateurs coming from Gotland, the small island, singing. Never heard of them before, never heard of them after. And then we had one or two songs that might at least get some points in the Eurovision, and one of them won, thank God. But we had some problems here. It was going downhill, because what would happen the year after that and the year after that? We wouldn't even have these singers from Gotland anymore. So we said something must be done. And then we just sat down and we revamped the whole thing. We took it out to the audience. Instead of having it in Stockholm and Gothenburg and Malmö, we went on tour for 6 weeks. And we, instead of having 10 acts in the final, we picked 32. And then we had four semifinals. We had one heat where the lucky losers could make it into the final. And then we had a super final. And we didn't put that on a small theater. We put it in the biggest arena at that time, the Globe Arena. And we had our doubts, for sure. Would we attract the big names of artists, of songwriters? Would we attract the audience? In my nightmares, I could see the small arena in Sundsvall with 200 people sitting there and 10 dance bands singing. But luckily enough, we seemed to attract, of course, we did a lot of talking to the record companies, the management of artists, and we did some special invitations to some artists. And luckily, we had 32 quite good songs, and we seemed to attract new areas of music, new artists from different kinds of genres. And in the end, it was a big success. We had record viewing figures every Saturday for 6 weeks. And we sold out every arena in the country. And the cost was actually just the double what we used to pay for one night, and now we get six nights with good ratings. So it was, we believed in it, and we believed that talking to management, to record companies, we could have the attractive artists, and then it just kept on rolling.
But Kevin, I imagine if you had gone to the BBC and said, look guys, what we need to do is hire Wembley Stadium and, you know, have lots of semi-finals, they would have said, sorry, here's a budget, you can fill the dog and duck if you want.
Yep. You know the BBC too well. So, Swanti, what was the magic that made the audience come to your first year? Because if they've decided doing it in the UK, if they sort of lived through it when it wasn't so successful, how come in your first year they suddenly took it under their wing?
I think the key was that we went out in the countryside, and you know, Sweden in the beginning of February is pretty dull and dark. And here was a chance for the people in Skellefteå, in Borås, etc., to put on their shiny shoes and nice dresses and go and glittery for one night. And that made it
that's
sold
really
out.
Interesting.
Also, in each place, we managed to put the big names out there. So there were at least two or three big names that they knew before that would come and sing in their city. And we did a lot of promotion, of course, in the week leading up to this. And that was the
key,
I think.
Svante, can I ask you?
Sure.
If I understand it correct, here in the UK, the BBC owns the event.
Yeah. Yes.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So how is it in Sweden? Is it a television program?
It is actually a contest between TV companies.
Yes.
So it is the TV company who must be a member of the EBU, the European Broadcasting mm-hmm. Union, who enters a song and competes.
So you have a separate.
It's done in the entertainment department of SVT, but now it's so big that we cooperate with big touring companies, and we talk to all the cities that will host it. We have marketing people involved, etc., etc.
So, is different television companies taking Eurovision depending on the quality of their bids? Is that?
No, normally it's one company in each country who enters
sure.
the song.
But
in some countries there are more than one TV company who is a member of the EU.
Yeah, but in Britain we've got ITV.
Yeah.
And we always get into the finals, to the chagrin of Turkey and others, because we give so much money to the Eurovision
correct.
Contest. So, as with so often, actually, a surplus of taxpayers' money is a problem rather than the solution.
But isn't that the problem? That Britain is always guaranteed.
So they're complacent.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think you're right. I mean, I worked for the EBU for 8 years, and this is something I'm not so proud of. I mean, it's very undemocratic. Five countries, the biggest five countries in Europe, automatically go to the final. And just because they pay more money than the smaller countries. And I mean,
Spain is one of them, and they don't have any money.
That's true.
But how sustainable is it if the UK, which contributed 310,000, I think, last year, if they don't make that big contribution, are you going to make it tougher for the smaller countries to enter?
I don't think so. I mean, nowadays, Eurovision is a huge affair as well. I mean, we have sponsors and we sell tickets, etc., etc. So I think the Eurovision Song Contest could survive without Britain, or without Spain, or without Germany.
That's a very interesting point. Britain, well, the BBC doesn't actually spend around 310,000. That's actually not much money in terms of television. And Eurovision, over the last at least 4 or 5 years, has, on the final night, has had about 8 or 9 million viewers. I mean, that's huge viewing figures, and that's one of the largest in the whole of Europe. So Eurovision without the UK would actually be quite a sizable chunk of its audience. And I think it's quite wrong to say that the BBC doesn't really care about Eurovision. It does, because it does give them money. But last year it beat The Voice, which was a huge investment in BBC funds. And it also beat Britain's Got Talent, which was on the same night, and it's probably going to be the same on Saturday. So it's quite wrong to say that people in the UK don't care about Eurovision.
Yes, you're right. But the criticism, I don't think, goes to the Eurovision night itself. I think that's great, to the surprise of the authorities. The criticism is at our complete failure to have anything resembling a democratic way of choosing a contest, or having a song which reflects even 10% of what our music industry is capable of doing. And that's where the criticism of the BBC is aimed at the selection, I think, rather than simply being the channel that everybody watches it on, because you watch it no matter what channel it was on.
I think it's quite, well, perhaps not, because I remember last year when the BBC had a very successful Olympics and everyone was watching and massive few figures, and the Paralympics were on Channel 4, and the amount of criticism that they had for showing adverts during the opening ceremony was huge. Brits aren't used to having adverts during big television events like this, and I don't think people would appreciate having adverts during Eurovision either.
Right.
About half of the countries showing Eurovision, they have ads in there.
Absolutely, they do, yes.
We have breaks for it.
Yeah, so the BBC coverage of Eurovision is quite different from most other countries, though. We put a lot of effort into our coverage.
And we enjoy the commentator. He is so good.
Who?
He has
Which
good.
One? Graham Norton?
Well, the Terry was better.
Terry Wogan was even better.
Now, why did Terry Wogan... what's the real story? Kevin was Terry Wogan's producer.
He's
here
in English, then in Swedish.
And
because it takes the piss.
Yeah, of course. But this is interesting, because you could argue that Terry Wogan is to some extent responsible for Eurovision's reputation in Britain. Because he got into this little... I remember, you know, he was there once. He said, oh, this is Norway, you can't get a drink here for love and money, you know. And he would just take the mickey, and it was very funny. It was very funny, but it also cemented the idea that these guys are here for our amusement and we're going to laugh at them with their funny hairstyles. This is what I want to ask Kevin. I mean, you must have had discussions with Terry saying, look, are we going too far taking the mickey here? And Terry, I think he got annoyed because he got fed up with the block vote system, didn't he, in the end?
Very much.
Which has kind of unwound itself recently, but... Yep. Was it a conscious decision that this is what we're going to do? We're going to basically send it up. We're going to cover it, but make jokes at it.
I don't think Terry thought like that. It's just that because he'd done it for so long, I think that each year he just sort of tended to go further with it, and it's just that was his style. I don't think he thought about it seriously at all.
Yeah,
that was just the way he was.
And do you know what the do you know how Graham Norton is comparing? I mean, I always try to watch foreign coverage when I can.
Okay.
I don't like the way he introduces it, but anyway. I mean, is Graham Norton regarded as a worthy successor to?
Oh yes, very much so. But he is quite different to Terry.
But he completely takes the mickey out of it. He makes out like it's some great big camp festival, isn't it?
He loves it.
How do you explain the drop from 2 years ago, 12 million viewers in the UK, to 9 million the following year? Which, by the way, I think is great value. The Voice was 22 million, and Eurovision beat that. But there was a 3 million drop, so are we having to arrest future decline?
Well, wasn't that Britain's Got Talent?
I'm talking about the Eurovision Song Contest.
Surely Britain's Got Talent was opposite it, wasn't it?
I have no idea. I was only interested in Eurovision.
But it must be. I'm sure that would be why.
So what was the viewing the year before?
No. I don't know.
Okay. Well,
but surely. But that would be the same problem this year. With Britain Got Talent against it, that's going to have the same effect.
Well, it's in Sweden last year, 4 million watched it, and I think there's, 9 million people in Sweden, so that's a pretty high penetration. So my study is probably lower in Britain, and I suspect of those who watch it, a good chunk are foreign born anyway, like Katrina here. Is there something that we can... I mean, if you were called back and said, right, Kevin, you can have all the money you want, we want to save Eurovision, we want to be in it, and we want to win it, what would you do?
Well, I think you know, Svante had the right idea. I think it's very good to take it into the provinces and get as big an audience from all around the country. But we've got to get the right songwriters and performers. That's what we need.
And yeah, but look how close Andrew Lloyd Webber and Jade came.
Yeah.
You know, that was number 5. That was a great effort and a really well-produced show. I thought they put together with the little panel and with a really fine song, like a typical... Well, it was a typical Andrew Lloyd Webber song, but it was earmarked for Eurovision as well. And I thought... this is the way. This is the way forward. Get a really good songwriter and have an X Factor style competition to find the person who's going to represent the UK.
But the trouble is, the BBC didn't then take that forward. Having
was that about
achieved
money?
What they achieved that year, if they'd moved it on, they could have done very well.
I think so.
But the BBC, I get the feeling that the BBC doesn't really want it. I mean, I met Mark Thompson before he left and bored him to death for half an hour about his sins against Eurovision. And I told him that he was, you know, that what we're doing, putting Humperdinck up there. And he was saying, well, we put somebody old and rubbish. We had no idea that the Russians would put people even older and even worse than us. Which, of course, you can just imagine that going down well in the BBC boardroom. But do you remember the Russian grannies? I mean, they had fairly decent choreography, I would say, with that little baking thing they had going on. They had
Come on and dance. Everybody did. It was so memorable. I still can't get it out of my head.
It was actually not a bad wee song, which they sang in their native language, and they had played the ethnicity card, and they had authenticity. And that sort of thing goes down well in Eurovision. The Russians put some thought into it. And I don't think that Britain did. And given that, I mean, and before Katrina came along, Alan Yentob wanted to get rid of it, I think, in 1994. But you know, before Jonathan and King came and rescued it. So do you think the BBC might just agree to give it over to ITV and see the guys who brought us X Factor could bring us something else, bring us a Melody Festival?
Well, the problem is the BBC is not run by entertainment people anymore. In fact, there's nobody there.
Was it ever?
Yes, it was. Yes.
But yeah, I don't know much about it.
In the Jim Moyer days, there was people who ran entertainment who knew about entertainment.
Weren't you the head of entertainment?
And we haven't had anybody like that for 10 years.
Right.
Nobody's got that passion, and that's what you need, someone who's got a passion for entertainment.
But Absolutely. The BBC does do. I mean, Radio 1 is still very popular when it comes to... I mean, you think there'd be some creative talent there sloshing around this giant organisation?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, okay.
Not in the right places, anyway.
Speaking from the unentertainment list of the BBC, why does it matter who wins or who does badly? What is the value of Eurovision?
I can answer that, but I ought not to. Anyone here want to?
For the same reason you're going to the Olympics, you want to win. You want to be the best. You want to be recognized by the entire continent. I mean, that's a simple reason, I think.
Do you mean what's the value of Eurovision or the value of winning?
No, why would any country want to win, she's saying? What does it matter if we suck or if we come first?
And I think maybe the general public think it's a colossal waste of money if we don't try harder and we always come in last. And also, I think sort of for just self-preservation and pride, it's just ugly to keep coming in so poorly and, you know, second to last place. It's kind of shameful for a country that really your pop culture, pop music culture is outstanding and unrivaled by anyone else in the world.
When you won, you said it was a double landslide because you'd won, was it just after Blair's victory, wasn't it?
Yes.
And do you think you managed to raise the nation's spirits even further with that?
Well, I think we managed to connect with the atmosphere in the room because we did it at the point in Dublin, and there was already this fantastic feeling in the United Kingdom that we were back and things can only get better, and there was such a feel-good factor going on. All I had to do was go out there and open my mouth and sing the words, and we're all going to shine a light together. All shine a light to light the way. And, you know, we were there. Everybody had goosebumps, and everybody just felt like, yes, you know, it's tomorrow, now. You know, we're there.
So were you part of Cool Britannia then?
Not me. How could I ever be a part of that winning Eurovision? I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right song and connect with the atmosphere of the people.
But my answer to your question is this, that Eurovision is the most watched non-sporting event in the world. I mean, go back to what I was saying earlier, 60 million people are going to watch us suck. And I think the kind of, the face that we present to the world, it depends if you think it matters what they think of you. I am a Europhile, and I think it does. I really do think it does. And it matters in ways that we may not care about. But I think Eurovision is, you know, it's an incredible and I think a consequential contest. And can you imagine if there was a world wine competition and France would come last every single year? You'd think something is wrong. Maybe let's get all this great wine we've got in our country and submit a bottle. And that's what I think here. And I actually wonder if the way the BBC did the focus on the regions was perhaps wrong, because if you're good at music, you tend to want to come to London, unfortunately. I mean, as a Scot, I hate to admit that, but it's kind of true. Even if you're Ukrainian, you're good at music, you want to come to London. I mean, their winning entry was produced right here in Soho.
But not winning Eurovision hasn't put them off.
Doesn't put who off?
People who love of music, wanting to make music come into our...
Yeah, they do, but I don't see why. Given that the broadcaster is a public service broadcaster, I think it's a public service to sniff out the talent we've got in this country and show it to the world. And I don't think it's that difficult. I mean, we are the country of X Factor. And I actually think, I'd rather thought Kevin would dispute what I was saying, but he's rather reinforced it, that this is now beyond the BBC as it is currently structured. I think the BBC should stick to, period drama and just leave Eurovision and pop contests to the guys like Svante, and perhaps you can come here and actually save it. We actually had Sven Göran Eriksson coming here, did pretty good with the football team. So wow. I can see it now. We will be the man to lead us to the promised land.
I hate the weather here.
I think that the BBC is missing a trick because it is actually the Eurovision Song Contest, which you mentioned earlier. And it's not the difference between the song contest and the X Factor. The X Factor, you're going after the artist. Song contest, you're going after the song. And it's a certain irony that this week is the Ivor Novello Awards, which celebrates UK songwriters, which are amazing. It's the biggest. I mean, people travel from America to be part of the Ivor Novellos. And yet, the song that we have representing us in Eurovision is co-written by an American. So it's a perfect chance to kind of reach out to the songwriting community. And, I mean, I'm a songwriter, I'm a board member of BASCA, and there's an incredible interest among songwriters to get exposure for the craft of songwriting. Mm. And people in the music industry love the Ivor Novellos because there's a real respect for songwriting. So I think that, what the Swedish... Eurovision has done too. It's like it is about the song in the end. Yeah, you get some famous people to sing them because obviously that will make people watch the show. But instead of looking as happened with Jade, where also there was an American writer and a British writer, have some famous people singing songs by UK songwriters. Mm.
So I think we've got the seeds of recovery right here. So step one is that we make it a competition addressed to songwriters, British songwriters, saying, right, it's an art.
Swedish songwriters do. That's why they're doing so well.
And we say to them, can you come up with a tune which crosses all these cultural boundaries, which can make sense, which is a really difficult thing to get exactly right. And we do this. We take it out of the hands of the BBC because they've lost interest, and to be frank, I think they wouldn't mind. I would give it to ITV or Sky or something. Who knows? And then we would need, I think, a Swedish expert to come and lead it, don't you think? I think we should draft somebody, maybe tear up somebody's passport before he goes back to Malmö tomorrow. And then we would... And do you think, Svante, that we should have... If you're starting from ground zero, as we are, then you go out and you make it town hall talent contest. You make it a live event first and then bring it to the television.
Well, you must start with your national contest, how to find the best song, how to find the best songwriter. And you should definitely do that in a TV show. I mean, I saw some of the national TV shows here selecting your winner. It really looked like crap. Small studio, nothing really... Not the big type of show that you expect, because when you're on the stage of the Eurovision Song Contest, you're on the biggest stage there is. Why don't do it big time also when you select your song here? And I mean, obviously, the Idol, the Voice, X Factor works. Here you already have a format that's been around for almost 60 years. Use that one and turn it into maybe a new format or how to select it with juries or whatever, televoting, but do it big. And I'm sure that if you do it big, it will also be interesting commercially for songwriters, for artists, etc. Start there, and you will sell records, you will get more interest instead of having this guy, I didn't know that, having one guy picking old singers.
But I think that's so underhanded that we don't even know who that person is to slap him. I mean, who's choosing the material? I mean, it's like you said, there are songwriters out there who would give their eye teeth to be the person who's written the song that's going to represent the UK. There's so much incentive there for a songwriter that you'd think you'd get such a great quality if you just said to all of them,
I don't think anybody's aware of, when it happens or how it happens.
You know, in the old days, you used to record a song on a cassette and go running down to Berner Street, I think it was, and submit. And you could submit and submit. You had to pay a little and submit. You know, I submitted songs. Everybody did.
For Eurovision, no?
Yeah. Every songwriter I know would submit songs. And then somebody had to just sit there and listen through one after the other.
But, Katrina, is the brand so tarnished now that the industry kind of doesn't want to do that? Is the brand... do we have to rescue the brand first before we can get the talent to put forward?
I'm still... My point is... As a songwriter who's hungry for a hit is going to see this as a huge opportunity. And wow, couldn't they be the one to save the day if the selection process would allow that special little song of his or hers to come through and then find someone worthy to perform it? I mean, maybe I just think that's the way, rather than have one person who's sneaking around and saying, this year it's going to be Engelbert, or this year it's going to be Bonnie, and we don't know who this person is. Are you that person?
You've actually preempted what I was about to ask. Do any of you know, in this Stalinist secret process, what it was that led to, A, Engelbert Humperdinck being chosen last year, and B, Bonnie Tyler being chosen this year? Because I had this idea that both had been chosen because of some spurious idea that perhaps there was a residual continental European popularity about them.
That certainly was...
We know that Engelbert Humperdinck was king of Schlager in Germany in the 70s, a sort of Carol Gott type figure. Yeah. Perhaps that, and I know that Bonnie Tyler was also huge in Germany after she ceased being huge here. But do any of you have any insight or ideas about why we have chosen and put forward these two quite embarrassing past-it-no-hopers that actually mean nothing to British culture these days, or say nothing about British culture to the outside world? And why the hell were they chosen?
No idea.
But if anybody can guess, Kevin, you can. I mean, you know the BBC.
I know, but it's so strange. It's so different. I left 2 years ago, and it's so different to it as it was when I was there. But, I mean, I know they chose Engelbert because they thought he was big in Eastern Europe.
So it was residual popularity.
Manoj, you work for the BBC.
But who actually...
Do you have a guess? If you were to guess as to how they arrived at...
As how they arrived at it? Probably really? Someone on an internship.
I know. I'll tell you my own theory, that I think the BBC has got a sort of faintly Europhobic idea of these guys are all crappy anyway. Who's crappy? I know. Engelbert. And also they think, right, residual foreign appeal. I mean, Bonnie Tyler, she sang Lost in France. That'll do. She'll be sunk in Sweden. That's fine. Let's send her on her way. But I do think it's somebody who's got very little understanding of what the contest is about, except they believe it is basically a trash contest.
Why doesn't Britain pick somebody like... I don't know, I don't personally like it. Charlie Winston, who's British and massive in France, resident in France, pretty big in Germany as well. Why doesn't Britain look to Brits who are popular in continental Europe? Don't necessarily have a focus here. Why don't they do that research?
I mean, quite often, actually, the winning formula is to choose an immigrant and present it to the world, so you can get two block votes, actually. I mean, the Norwegian did that very well. I mean, you know, it's...
Estonia did that with half of their winning entry.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't really think choosing... I don't think the nationality or the birth of the singer is that important. But, I don't know, Katrina, what do you think?
Well, it was suggested to me by the BBC that I adopt an English accent. And go, Bonnie, Governor, give it up. Yeah, we're so happy to be here. And then they decided, okay, we don't have to go that far. It was a little bit tricky, yeah, being an American.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, a little bit, but I think it actually speaks quite well of a country where you get somebody, I mean, take Laureen, her parents are both Moroccan, the one who won last year. And it kind of actually drives home the fact that we are now an integrated continent where people and the parents do move from one place to the other. I don't think it's a negative, although I certainly, I do think that the American music, when I heard Bonnie Tyler's, you know, Nashville kind of influence, I thought, well, who cares about that in Europe? It's not many people.
I think when you're too smart and start think that Engelbert Humperdinck is big in Ukraine, then you're in trouble. Just find a good song, a good singer, and a nice act, and you will win it.
Well, having said that, Sweden are now the world champions in being too clever. You guys have got 9 foreign countries voting on the semi-finals, and you recently overturned your winner. The guy the Swedes voted for was kicked out because the overseas panels for the semi-finals, they wanted somebody else. So surely you guys are asking more than anybody else, what do they think of us in Italy or, you know, Tel Aviv or whatever? Are you not?
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got it more scientific than any other country ever done before.
Because we've made some mistakes during the years. We picked a song for Finland, which was like a glam rock song played by a band called The Ark. And we thought, this is a really good, and it's kind of a retro song, so you go back and everyone remembers it with big joy. The problem was that half of the countries voting, they didn't even know what glam rock was or retro rock. They didn't have that. Mm-hmm. And probably the same thing with Engelbert Humperdinck. They didn't know who this guy was because they didn't know him that time.
We'll take a couple more questions on the floor, then we'll wrap up. Sorry.
I've got a question for Fraser. You're saying that Melody Festival is actually Sweden's biggest television show. It's not just a big television show.
Yeah.
It's the biggest one there.
Awesome.
And yes, a lot of people say that we should have something similar in the UK. We're talking about the songwriters, and everything that everyone said is absolutely great. I completely agree that we do need to find great songwriter talent. Who are going to sing these songs? In Melody Festival, we need established artists because the Swedish music environment is very different. It's much smaller than the UK. Mm-hmm. And these artists, the record companies use this to promote their artists, and the competition to get on the show is huge, and they're guaranteed really good sales. That's not necessarily the case in the UK. So are we looking to try and persuade big artists to compete in a UK Melody Festival?
I think we would need another Katrina scale victory to get the big artists to change their views about Eurovision. So I think it will be. I don't think we're ever going to get Adele doing this. But I actually don't think that in this country, one of the things I think the problems we face, lack of talent is not one of them, I think.
True.
I really do think if we had an open primary session, we would find some strange Susan Boyle type character nobody would have thought. I mean, this is what the X Factor does. It sniffs out fantastic talent and it does very well, including abroad. So that's the one area. I mean, how we get it out of the hands of the BBC is a problem, finding talent, I don't think.
So how many songwriters do we have in the competition?
Well, there's about over 3,000 entries, and of course, the big songwriters, they send in maybe 50 songs each.
Because I think here you have a huge opportunity, because you must have so many talented people that can write songs, and all of a sudden they have the stage for both songwriters and new people that would like to come into the song industry in another way than X Factor or the other successful ones.
It's interesting.
But the artist thing, and just to clarify, I'm Swedish and live in the UK, and I've lived there for a long time, so I've kind of watched both. And I think that to get artists let's face it, there are so few music shows on television that artists are really hungry for exposure on national television. All you need is to kind of, if you reach out to labels and like, you know, the songwriters, or the songwriting is obviously a separate thing, but with artists, if an artist knows that another artist is going to be on there that is sort of semi, you know, credible, then of course they're going to be on there. And then that kind of spirals. So it's definitely not a lost cause. All you need is to kind of change, because that is what happened in Sweden. Mm. You just need to slightly change that whole concept. And like I said, because, and as Katrina said, both songwriters and artists are hungry for exposure on television, because what you have is like Late Night with Jules.
But there's always going to be a perceived come down to Eurovision, because your expectations are very, very high.
You look at pop acts, where, you know, I mean, the UK pop acts, that would surely be, I mean, yeah, like you said, Adele wouldn't do it, and probably Tiny Tempo wouldn't do it.
No.
But
But I just did a TV show with Stooshy, and I think they would be just about the perfect profile.
Yeah. Mm.
You know what I'm saying? You know, they've had one hit. They're kind of hungry.
Exactly.
It could be exposure for them.
To
European,
be shown for
young.
9 million people.
Yes. Yeah.
Pretty good, sir.
Yeah, just a couple of points. So the reality thing, I think that's being the answer. I guess the two actually sites as being the biggest exports of reality show would be One Direction and Susan Boyle.
Yeah.
In terms of global, but neither of those.
Neither of those.
One for reality shows that they're in. So Susan Boyle came second in Prince of Talent.
Sure, but
she went, and One Direction came third on X Factor. So that doesn't really. I didn't see how that follows. So to go to my second point, which would be in terms of the Engelbert Humperdinck thing. So I know, for example, that this is because they put the letter on their Twitter account. So a band called Hertz, who are quite popular,
two-piece,
Manchester, and they were offered the chance to compete in Eurovision, but they turned it down, and they didn't say why. But I can only assume that because it's because of the reputation of Eurovision is so toxic. In fact, the Hertz, who are a fairly credible synth pop band, quite dark, quite moody, would be competing against. In that year, they would be competing against
was
Russian
that
brands.
For Hertz?
That was for the Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah.
But the thing is that there was no local competitions. What happens in Sweden is you've got 6 weeks of build-up.
Yeah.
So you've got 6 weeks of exposure for bands going and playing, and it's the highest... You know, highest rated show, and it didn't happen overnight. But
like, this is what we're going back to. The music scene in Britain is based in London. It's not based in the principalities. I mean,
yeah.
A tiny scene going in Birmingham.
No, but they travel in Sweden. They travel around. The people that are competing in like a little town up north are not necessarily from that town.
Exactly.
Yeah, and also, I mean, Loreen, who won last year for Sweden, who did so well, she actually came third or fourth in the Swedish Pop Idol. I mean, she is what you might regard as a failure from a national talent contest who made it big on Eurovision, and it's horses for courses, really. I mean, I think Hertz, their music, I don't think is really right for Eurovision at all. I mean,
but they're massive in Germany, they're massive.
Sure, but it's not the right. You've got to have a sort of Katrina-style optimism to really win that. I don't know, they're good and I like them, but I'm not sure they're... You know, their vibe is the right Eurovision vibe, and I can imagine the BBC Stalinist guy thinking, "Oh, it hurts. They're doing well. I won. Yeah, they're from Manchester. Let's get them."
But you can't change the cultural mentality of people in this country. You can't try and be like the Swedes because you had ABBA. You know, from ABBA grew all of the pop culture
Absolutely.
Of Sweden that has a great, loving, warm association with Eurovision. The UK just doesn't. It's still a little bit. I wonder in that, you know, and puppet on a string, and you know, it's a bit
right.
silly. It's a bit kind of what we sort of laugh at. It's like in America, the Miss World pageant or something. You know, it's a competition of for beautiful women, a competition for great songs. Nah, can't be doing that.
Do you know Russia won both in 2006? Eurovision and Miss World. Anyway, sorry.
How'd you know that?
Oh, you'd be amazed at what I know. Right, now two questions and then we'll wrap it up. Sir.
Sorry, I just wanted to return to the earlier slightly dry academic point, but maybe it is the wrong question. Maybe it doesn't terribly matter who wins it, and the true spirit of Eurovision is a little bit beyond that. I've done a fairly extensive amount of research on both Eurovision fans and sport fans. And trust me, the Eurovision fans are generally a much, much nicer bunch of people.
Do you have a niceness question? How nice are you in a scale of 10?
I mean, why does winning necessarily matter so much? Maybe the BBC doesn't do well with the pre-selection. I mean, it doesn't do with pre-selection, so it doesn't do particularly well with it at the moment. But isn't it maybe more important to put the event out there to broadcast to the two semi-finals and to have this bit of being in Europe at the time where with UKIP and, you know...
So just fumble along and hope we get lucky.
Or even withdraw from it completely, as we're talking about, which, as the Czechs did recently.
But
I mean,
to people, it doesn't, to Eurovision fans in this country, it doesn't terribly always matter if they win. Sometimes it's almost a better anecdote to have someone who goes there and can't quite sing.
Yes,
you're
right.
That's refreshing. No, that's refreshing. That's a whole new way to look at it. No, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a different way of looking at it. So just kind of hope for the luck. It's like every other year we do quite poorly, and so in between that we do all right.
Yeah, and nationalism comes very fleetingly.
Except this year.
One year you support one country, and God knows you might even vote for Denmark
But I think it is about national. To me, it's about national pride. I mean, all I actually want from Europe is cheap flights in Eurovision. The rest of it, I couldn't care about. And I want Britain to do very well. And I feel embarrassed in thinking of these guys in Georgia who've got such great impressions of Britain, and then seeing Bonnie Tyler of Marlborough Voice, singing about. She's a fine woman, but to me, it's about national pride. But I'm unusual. Last question, ma'am.
I don't want to open up all kind of worms just for wrapping up. We've talked a lot about the selection process, as if we get the song right, we're going to win. But what about block voting? And is there a whole other issue why we're not winning to which is something because no one likes it very much?
There's an academic study done recently suggesting we couldn't win for exactly that reason. This is the reason that Terry and Kevin quit, because they thought it was rigged. This isn't a talent question anymore. This is just a little formula, and if you get Norway, they get all the Nordic votes, so they get this Minsk-born Russian to their bloat, they'll mop up all of the... And, I think that there is an element of that, but I think gaming that system, as Norway did that year, and I think is actually part of the skill. I mean, countries will always have similar allegiances, and to me, the great joy of Eurovision comes in the voting, and you see the clash of politics and cultures and blocks. And there's been another academic study suggesting there's an austerity block this year, that all the countries who are suffering the worst cuts are going to club together, in which case we should win by a mile, shouldn't we? So these blocks might work in our favour. I mean, for the first 14 years of Eurovision, there was a Britain-Irish kind of Anglo-block that worked in our favour. But to me, the blocks, rather than Terry Wogan saw this as the nemesis of Eurovision, but I just see it as another level on one of the greatest and most exciting games in entertainment's world. But what do you think of the blocks? Do you think the Swedes, when they select it, do you think they think, right, well, this is going to go well with the Slavs? Or?
No. First of all, we changed the rules 5 years ago. So now it's 50% professional juries and 50% televoting. And, first of all, there's no such thing as political voting. I mean, you can't get the people of Russia, you must vote for Ukraine or whatever. They vote for simple reasons. They vote for maybe the same language. They vote maybe because an artist is also a big star in your country, like in the former Yugoslav countries. They more or less talk the same language. And if you're a big artist in Serbia, you're also a big artist in the other new countries. And it's also a matter of liking that special music genre. I mean, they like the same kind of music. Like in Scandinavia, we tend always to like the Danish song or the Norwegian song because it's kind of the same rhythms. Same thing goes for Yugoslavs and ex-Soviet states. The only really true example is Cyprus and Greece, because there's so many Greeks living in Cyprus, so they always vote for Greece and vice versa.
Okay.
Gotta stop you there. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Fraser. Fraser. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Well, having happy birthday sung to me by Katrina, I can now die happy. Thank you. Thank you all. Anyway, well, thanks for all coming today. It was a lovely surprise, and I hope you had as much fun as I did, though I doubt it.
And thank Nicola.
And thank Nicola for organising all. Thanks to the panel. And thanks to Sweden. Thank you.
Thank you.